This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. You'd be right to associate libraries with books. But what the tradition of access to books offered was access to greater knowledge, resources, and oftentimes enjoyment. Today, in the digital age, modern libraries have evolved alongside both advances in technology and the changing needs of their communities. You can still check out a book from your library, but today you might also be able to check out a morning yoga class or a seed bank for a backyard garden. How are modern libraries evolving? We'll explore that today. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881, and we'll try to get you into the conversation. Joining me now is the Indiana State Librarian, Jacob Speer. Jake, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Wendy Knapp, Deputy Director of Statewide Services at the Indiana State Library. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Let's start by getting a little background about your job as the Indiana State Librarian, Jacob. Can you explain what your role entails?
Yes, the State Library is a state agency that oversees library services in the state. We provide support through training, programs, and other things to support the Indiana library community, and this includes academic libraries, public libraries, school libraries, even prison libraries, to help them provide better and the best service they can provide to Hoosiers.
And so what are the goals then of the Indiana State Library?
Well, we're a wide-ranging library, so our goals are to provide information literacy and access to libraries. So we do that through Inspire, which is our collection of online databases. We provide training to librarians so that we have a more informed, better prepared library staff. We're also a research library ourselves. So we're located at 140 North Senate Avenue, and we are a large federal depository and a research library in genealogy. So our goals are wide ranging across librarianship.
We also, just within the last year, the Indiana Historical Bureau became a part of the Indiana State Library. So preserving Indiana's history and keeping the story of Indiana going is a big part of what we do. So
let's talk about some of the broad trends that we've seen across libraries in the last several years. If we zoom out and look at circulation numbers in the past 10 years or so, do we see any patterns?
Okay, it's really interesting. Nationwide, you'd see declining or flat circulation of physical items. Even, you know, that's going back 10 years. If you go back 20 years, it's still significantly higher than it was 20 years ago. So overall, readership, I would say, is going up. It's just not necessarily the physical items themselves. Libraries do have ebooks, obviously, as well. And that circulation is, of course, through the roof. But
right. And so, you know, the overall, you know, the recession had a big impact on library usage. So in 2008, after that, there was a big spike as far as number of visits to the library, you know, checking out all types of materials. And now that the economy is doing better, it's not quite the same numbers as before.
And another trend in circulation is that it's not just books anymore that people can check out. What kinds of changes have we seen here?
So ebooks are big, as Wendy mentioned. You know, that's a really big driver of that. There's also people are checking out all types of things that you've mentioned, you know, cake pans and tools and lots of things that maybe we wouldn't have thought of before. And even more, you know, tablets and other electronics devices as well are being checked out.
Now, is that, though, something new, the idea of checking out cooking supplies and tools? Because when we were kind of preparing this show today, that was something that I had not heard of personally.
It's not super new, I wouldn't say. It's, you know, libraries just as community hubs, as places where you can go get any kind of information or knowledge that you need. And in whatever tools you need to use that knowledge is always there. One of the things that we do circulate at high rates now is actually hotspots, making sure that we're getting internet access to the most underserved areas of the state.
And of course, one of the most significant forces of change in the past few decades has been the rise of technology, as we've kind of talked about. How has digitization change the game in libraries?
It's really big all across, from even small libraries that may be digitizing their community papers to at a state level where we're digitizing our manuscripts collection. If you go to indianamemory.in.gov, you'll see a huge collection of what Indiana libraries collectively have digitized using grant dollars from the state library and local dollars. And it's just huge, and it's really had a big impact as far as access to our collective history and specifically Indiana history. You can view from diaries and manuscripts to images and poster collections and just a whole host of things from institutions as large as Indiana University to as small as a small community public library are all found there.
And I would just add to that that the digitization technology is just becoming so phenomenal to watch. We're able to digitize three-dimensional objects now, and libraries have, you know, 3D printers in places. And some libraries have really been exploring things like virtual reality, where you could take the letters written to a famous person and, like, inspect them very closely in a way that you couldn't in the real world because we need to protect the paper.
We're talking about the evolution of libraries with Indiana State Librarian Jacob Speer and Deputy Director of Statewide Services at the Indiana State Library, Wendy Knapp. We talked about the circulation rates at libraries being kind of stagnant in the last few years. But what about the general attendance? Does that mean that less people are coming through the doors?
Actually, it's actually increasing. In 2018, over 30 million Hoosiers visited their library and our total visits. And so that is actually increasing. Programming at the libraries, there's over 150,000 programs with attendance of 3.2 million. And so those are showing healthy increases across Indiana. And also non-library programs. So people are using, as Wendy mentioned, the library as their community hub. And there was over a million program attendance, non-library program attendance in libraries as well. So meetings of all types.
So what do you think accounts for that? In a world where you can get a book on your phone, in your pajamas, on your couch, in the comfort of your own home, what do you think keeps people coming through the doors of libraries?
A couple of different things. I think Eric Kleinberg's book, Palaces for the People, really puts it well when he describes it as, you know, the social interactions are just vital. And with the world becoming more and more online, we're losing those places where we can go and interact with people and connect with people. And if we lose that, then we lose so much more. So libraries providing that in their communities is a big part of it. Also, you know, the ebooks are not necessarily, you know, that gettable for everyone in the world. You know, not everybody is going to be able to buy an ebook, even if it's only $9.99 or $5.99 on Amazon. They may not have that kind of disposable income. And, you know, they certainly don't have the disposable income to buy the hundreds of thousands of titles that are available from their library. So, you know, just having the variety of information available, I think, is a big part of it as well.
So a public resource and a public space for all.
Yes.
And libraries have a tradition of community programming, and we'll talk with a few local library officials later in the hour about how some of those programs have been reimagined. But can you walk us through some of the programs or resources that folks can access at their local library that they might just not know about, Wendy or Jacob?
Go ahead.
Early literacy is probably the biggest. So Storytime Hour is where, you know, parents or caretakers bring their children to the library, and oftentimes they're in the morning, but they can be all times of the day. But that first interaction with a librarian doing a story time is really huge. There's also teen programming has been around for a while, but it's really important as far as connecting with children once they get a little older. And there's a lot of public libraries are doing teen spaces. And of course, there's always been and will continue to be adult reading groups and other groups for seniors and others of all age. So it's really trying to connect with people from all age at their libraries with various types of library programming.
And there are a number of people, too, that are into genealogy, and the Indiana State Library offers family genealogy consultations. What does that look like?
Yes, we have a very large genealogy collection, and you know, you can come to the library, you can go online and ask a librarian directly a question. We are one of the largest collections in the state, second only to Allen County, and one of the largest in the country. Since Allen County is such a strong collection, but we both collectively have a huge support staff and collection that can help Hoosiers find their family background. And this service, of course, is at no cost. If you go to the state library, there's Ask a Librarian resource there where you can at any time of the day type in a question, and within 24 to 48 hours we'll have a response to you.
This tradition of libraries adapting to the needs and interests of the communities is it's something that goes back years and years, and we can see it as far back as the dawn of the bookmobile. Can you explain a little about the history of bookmobiles, and do we still even use them?
Yeah, it's actually a very fun part of library history. It goes back to, you know, even before automobiles. You know, bookmobiles were horse-drawn carts to get to rural areas, to get to places where it may be difficult for people to get to the library during the hours that they're open. What was Plainfield's bookmobile thing? The really old one.
Did they have a carriage or something?
Yes, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Did they? Really? Yeah. On site?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jacob Spear, do we still have work to do in the last minute or so that we have in making sure that all Hoosiers have access to library resources?
Yes. You know, we do a great job in Indiana providing library service. We are 236 public libraries in the state, and they provide terrific service and really provide service that their communities are needing. There is 6.5% of Indiana's population is not served by a library district, but there are other ways to get service. But we collectively do a really strong job, but there is some work to be done.
And we were talking a little bit about this before the show with the producers. Many of us are familiar with the classic Dewey Decimal System used to organize library books. We've seen more and more libraries switching to different systems. Are the days of the Dewey Decimal System over?
Dewey Decimal is still alive.
Or numbered?
It's still alive. I think it will be around well past all of us.
Well, then what was that talk about then?
Well, there is Library of Congress, the LC system. And so that is another classification system that's more widely used. It's a little more flexible, it's more expansive than Dewey Decimal. Dewey Decimal is still used, particularly in smaller libraries and public libraries, because that system, although, you know, easy to joke about, it still works for many public libraries. But Library Congress is a little more expansive, I guess is the best way to put it.
We really appreciate you coming in to talk with us about libraries today. Jacob Spear, the Indiana State Librarian, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Wendy Knapp, Deputy Director of Statewide Services. Wendy, thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll bring in new voices to talk about the ways that county libraries have reimagined what it means to provide resources to a community in the modern era. As always, we would love your questions and comments on social media. What changes have you noticed at your local library? What resources would you like to see available? You can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on the changes within our libraries today, I want to mention our last show. Yesterday, we recapped the first season of the podcast Sick, which explores the story of a fertility doctor in Indiana who spent years deceiving his patients. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. Today, we're talking about the changes that technology and community needs have brought to public libraries today. And later, we'll also explore the shifts happening in academic libraries as well. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're joined now over the phone by Lisa Phipps, the Director of Marketing and Community Engagement at the Kokomo Howard County Public Library. Director Phipps, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're also joined on the line by Lisa O'Brien, Director of Development and Continuous Improvement at the St. Joseph County Public Library. Director O'Brien, we appreciate you making the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Director Phipps, let's start with you. it's pretty common to think of a public library as a place to go and check out books. But we know that doesn't do justice to what the Kokomo Howard County Public Library and many other libraries look like these days. What makes it different?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, listening to the previous segment, they were right on about the fact that technology truly has transformed our lives in general, plus, therefore, libraries. But it's also kind of created this need of getting back to being social with one another. And so we're finding more and more people coming to the library, and we host more and more programs all the time because people are looking for that connection. And, for example, what we do now is look at what does the community need and want. And we just recently got a grant to start a program called More Than a Memory, and we are going to lead Kokomo and Howard County in becoming dementia-friendly, which is a movement across the United States. I think there are 80 communities across the United States so far that are dementia-friendly. And what does that mean? Because with the baby boomers, dementia and Alzheimer's are becoming a huge crisis in healthcare. And we'll be hosting virtual dementia tours, and we'll be training hospitals and doctors and others and front-facing businesses on, you know, how to handle dementia with compassion and knowledge. I mean, and that's just one simple way that we have really transformed over the years. One big thing we did a few years ago was we had a Banksy exhibit. We were the first library in the world to host a Banksy. And for people who don't know what Banksy is, he's a street artist, world famous. And we drew people from 25 states and 4 countries to see that. So we find, you know, people are drawn to libraries for a variety of reasons. And we just need to figure out what they need and provide it.
Banksy in Kokomo. Wow.
Yeah.
Director O'Brien, the St. Joseph County Public Library is undergoing some major renovations right now, and we know that you are designing with the future in mind. What does that look like? What do you hope to provide the community with this redesign?
So what we're seeing is a need for physical space that doesn't just house books, physical space that provides a variety of ways that people learn and connect. We're seeing trends in an increase in attendance to our events and programs, increased use of our meeting rooms, and just an increase in visitors. So with this renovation and expansion, we're going to have more areas for activity, accessible meeting rooms for training, events, conferences, collaborative work. There will be a large 250-seat auditorium to allow for a range of programs, a new digital space that will go beyond just basic computer needs. It will introduce new technologies and support advanced tech training, a 38,000-square-foot community learning center. So we want to provide for a place for people to come and gather and learn together, because that's what we're seeing right now is what they want. And we're able to do all of this with our partners, the City of South Bend and the Community Foundation of St. Joseph County. They have been with us during this process and have lent their knowledge and experience with the community so we can truly reflect the diverse needs that we find here in the community.
And I'm always curious, when these big renovations happen, how much of it involves purging your inventory? How many books are lost when this sort of thing happens?
Well, we will start the new renovation with, when we open, we'll probably have a large new collection. But when we moved to our current temporary space, we really tried to preserve a lot of our collection. We really will see as time goes on the next 2 years how much we'll purge. We just try to reflect what the community wants. So if we see decreased usage, then we'll decrease our collection.
And this renovation, speaking of the community, has been a community effort. And as I understand it, funding has come from several sources. Does that tell you anything about the value that the community places on the library as a resource?
Yeah, I think that speaks to the value that people place on the library, that people are coming out and supporting us monetarily. That for sure tells us that the community wants and needs our library.
Director Phipps, speaking of physical spaces, I've heard that the Kokomo Howard facilities go beyond your 4 traditional indoor walls. Can you tell us a little bit about the unique spaces available and what they're used for?
Yes. At one of our locations, KHCPL Roosevelt, we have what's called a Nature Explore outdoor classroom. And so we do all kinds of fun projects out there year-round. We even, during the winter solstice program, we had free carriage rides for everyone who showed up. So we can use it all four seasons because, you know, people can put on coats. And we teach children gardening. We teach them just how to appreciate nature and to explore nature. And, you know, there's so much data out there about how learning about in nature increases your knowledge in a variety of ways, especially the tactile senses. And then we just got another grant, in addition to the More Than a Memory grant, to create a community butterfly garden at one of our locations, KHCPL South. And so we're partnering with the Master Gardener Association, and we got a grant from Duke Energy. Duke is wonderful for us. And we will be having programs out there, and we will be raising butterflies and having butterfly releases, which we had several over the last year and a half as we kind of prepared for this. And we'll be explaining the importance of native plants and the environment and milkweed and having a way station, and people are totally excited about it. We knew we hit something that the people would love when we had kind of a call out of, hey, we want to do this, what do you think? And we're going to have a butterfly release too. And we had so many people, it was standing room only in our meeting rooms, that we had the biggest meeting room we have. And we had close to 150 people for that, including people from Indianapolis and Noblesville and Marion. And it was like, whoa, this is something that people care about. They care about the monarch. They care about the nature, and they care about the environment. And so we have expanded with them. And just like in St. Joseph County and South Bend, how they're renovating their space, we'll be doing some renovations here at our main location. But we have found just ways to repurpose space as well. For example, we had a couple of chairs where people could sit and read, and we put exercise bikes there that you pedal while you read your Kindle or play your video games or whatever. And we have had such a huge response from the community who loves that. But then also we had librarians from New Zealand saying, hey, how did you make that happen? And so, you know, there's, because, you know, we can't always build huge buildings or make them bigger. And sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. We have fairly new buildings here. But, you know, you have to think of how do you repurpose? And that's one of the many ways we've repurposed with what we call passive programming.
I have this sort of fantastic vision in my head of reading a book outside and catching a butterfly on my finger. What a great idea. Director O'Brien, programming has traditionally been something that public libraries embrace, but have you seen an increase or a diversification of the programs offered at the St. Joseph County Public Libraries over the years?
Yes, we're doing more partnerships with local organizations to provide programming. We've partnered with La Casa de Amistad, the University of Notre Dame. So really trying to create programs with our community. We're also engaged in the Of By For All initiative out of California. And what that does is it trains our librarians to go deep into the community so that we can learn how to co-create with them. And it's all about forming strong relationships with the unique populations and finding out directly from them what is most relevant to them. And so that in that way, we can serve them better. We have 10 locations, and each one has a unique identity. So we want to ensure that we provide programs that that our community wants to attend. So if there's an area with a lot of young families, then we'll provide early literacy programs. So it's we're just trying to stay in tune with our community. Some examples are of us staying in tune with the the trends in our society and community. We're providing STEAM and coding classes, especially for the very young. We see kids much more interested in technology. We also have programs on topics of mindfulness and meditation, and we try to keep up with social issues, so maybe programs on fake news or immigration or whatever people are talking about. We want to provide a facility where they can openly express ideas and exchange information.
We're talking about the evolution of Indiana's libraries with Lisa Phipps, the Director of Marketing and Community Engagement at the Kokomo Howard County Public Library, and Lisa O'Brien, Director of Development and Continuous Improvement at the St. Joseph County Public Library. And we have a listener voicemail from Evelyn about library cards. Let's hear that now.
This is Evelyn. I'm calling from Evansville. I'm wondering why there isn't a statewide library card. I know that they commented there are some areas in the state that are not served. That would certainly help that. But also something as simple as some of the people, for example, in Pennsylvania County live a lot closer to the main libraries in Evansville, but yet they can't use the Evansville Public Library. And I just find that just ridiculous. So I'm a former librarian at the Evansville Public Library. I will say that right now, full disclosure. And I think that we need a statewide library card. It's not that hard, you guys. Everybody pays taxes. Bye.
Director Phipps, has anyone else brought up this idea of a statewide library card?
We get similar comments from patrons. We have a unique situation in Howard County in that there are a few townships over on the eastern part that are served by the Eastern Howard County School Corporation's library. And so a lot of people will move over to that school district because it's a great school, and then they find out, oops, now I can't use the Kokomo Library. And they have to get a plaque card, which is a public library access card, which it's kind of, for now anyway, it's a quasi-state library card because you pay a fee and you can access libraries. But I get what the caller is saying, and we would love to do that. I think that, you know, we are bound by certain restrictions because, you know, we serve those who pay the taxes into us. So I think there would have to be some kind of restructuring to make that happen. But, you know, we would be open to that. We even did a reciprocal borrowing for a while with Greentown because we wanted to serve those people. We didn't want to leave them out at all. And we thought if they could have access to both libraries, because their access is the elementary and high school libraries in that little section of the county. And we wanted them to have our resources. And they can come to our programs. Anyone can come to our programs from any county. But we wanted to be able to let them check it out. So I understand what she's saying. I would love to see it personally. I know our patrons would love that. I just don't know logistically and tax-wise and how that would all, you know, work, the pragmatic viewpoint of how does that work.
We have another voicemail from a listener named Martin who has a few comments about programming at libraries. Let's hear Martin.
Hello, my name is Martin. My wife has a book club. We live in Lawrence in Indiana, and so there's a dozen participants right there who visit the library at least once a month to get the book, and they check it out in e-versions or the physical book, and they're very happy with the services they get and the recommendations that they get from Lawrence librarians. And I love the concept of the little lending libraries that are set up in neighborhoods, and I wonder if those are supported at all by the Indianapolis library system. And finally, I think that public libraries should embrace virtual reality in a big way. That's really a coming technology. Maybe set up rooms where people can really get into the physical aspects of virtual reality as well as doing the minute study that Wendy talked about earlier. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Martin. Director O'Brien, with all of the changes at your library, has there been talk of virtual reality?
Well, we already have virtual reality that we offer. We do have a virtual reality system. Any patron could come in and use it. They put on the, I guess you would call it maybe goggles, and they interact with programs. So they can come to our Studio 304 Digital Lab, and that space is to introduce the community to new technology, whatever's on the cutting edge, so virtual reality included. So we welcome anyone in the community to come try it out.
And Director Phipps, we know that experiences are something that you've worked to offer at the Kokomo Howard County Library. For example, you offered Christmas card photo sessions to families. Can you tell us why you offered that and how it went?
Yeah, what we've also been doing is tapping our staff. And, you know, because you look around and your staff has, your different members of your staff have all of these different things that they do outside of work. I write children's books outside of work. We have people who are photographers outside of work or who teach sewing classes or whatever, just as a hobby or for extra money or whatever. And so we have someone on staff who was a photographer and a videographer. And so, you know, you think of family photos and how expensive they are, and then, you know, you don't own the copyright, so if you want more copies, you have to buy more. And so we set up a family photo night, and you could come. All you had to do was register because, you know, we wanted to allow enough time for everybody. And you would register, and then we took your photo, and we emailed you the JPEG. We gave you full rights to it. You didn't have to give us a copyright to it. And you could use it for any purpose. You could make calendars. You could use it for Christmas cards. You could just have a family photo. And we knew we hit on it. We hit the right button. When the first people who came like almost an hour early, and they had not been able to afford a family photo in 20 years. And the mom was crying, and everybody, even the kids, even the teen, you know, because she had older kids and then older teenagers, they were like so excited they were going to have a family photo taken. They were primping in the bathrooms and putting on makeup and curling their hair and going on and on. And they were so happy. And
I think we'll have to leave it at that. That sounds wonderful, though. There's a lot more to talk about, though. And if you have questions about the resources that are available to you at your local libraries, we encourage you to explore them. Lisa Phipps, Director of Marketing and Community Engagement at Kokomo Howard County Library, thank you for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Lisa O'Brien, Director of Development and Continuous Improvement in St. Joseph County Public Library, thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
We'll close out the show with a recent conversation I had with Carolyn Walters, the Ruth Lilly Dean of the University Libraries at IU. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back now with our discussion on the evolution of libraries. Now we turn our attention from public libraries to changes within academic libraries. We're joined now by the Ruth Lilly Dean of University Libraries at Indiana University, Carolyn Walters. Dean Walters, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You oversee and manage the Indiana University libraries. Can you give us a little insight into the size and scope of these libraries?
So what we're talking about today is the Bloomington libraries. And yes, I can give you a little bit of information about that. So we belong to something called the Association of Research Libraries that ranks libraries in terms of, well, multiple things. But the key barometer is expenditures, annual expenditures. And this past year, we ranked 13th among public institutions across Canada and the United States in terms of academic libraries. And we ranked 6th in the Big Ten, which for the Big Ten Academic Alliance, which is the academic arm of the conference, we have 15 libraries that identify because the University of Chicago is also part of that. So that includes all the Big Ten institutions plus the University of Chicago. So we rank 6th there. So we're large. We have multiple locations on this campus, including Wells Library, which is our primary location, which is actually a building of about 550,000 square feet. So large. We have the Jacobs School of Music Library. We have an off-site facility that includes two modules where we keep materials and we deliver them on campus. Two modules that house about 3 million volumes. And then we have other branches. We have a science library, a business and school of public and health library. And then we have a couple archives. We have the Wiley House Museum, which is the home of the first president of Indiana University. And then we have a moving image archive, which is our large film collection, which we're quite well known for.
So a lot of moving parts. And I would imagine anyone who's not familiar with the scope of a university library, and just about any university library, much less the multitude of them that you have there, would be, I think, overwhelmed to even think about all of the resources you have at your hands. And so we've been talking about changes and trends within modern libraries. And it seems like a lot of these trends mirror the mission and values of each library. And we've learned quite a bit about public libraries today, but the goals of an academic library are quite a bit different. Can you talk about those fundamental goals a bit?
Sure. I mean, obviously, as an academic institution, our library supports the research, teaching, and learning of the university. And we provide the collections and services and spaces that provide that support for innovation, for discovery, for teaching, and for learning.
So while the mission remains the same, we know that technology has significantly changed the way that libraries approach their work. How has digitization changed the way academic libraries approach business as usual?
Well, it has changed it significantly. It hasn't, as you mentioned, it hasn't changed our mission. It hasn't changed what we do, but it's changed how we do it, how we provide those services. So we have transitioned. So right now we have 10 million items in our electronic catalog. In 1842, we had 345. So you can see where we've gone with print, but also a big part of what we do now is electronic resources, whether we purchase them through subscriptions for journal articles, for example. We have over 2 million ebooks. But print material is still important to us, as well as our special collection. So it really has impacted how our students and how our faculty access our resources. Digitization has, whether we purchase things or whether we digitize them ourselves.
And IU libraries have made an effort to partner with technology specialists to increase the availability of resources to folks, but also to ensure that people know how to use these modern tools. Can you talk a little bit about what these partnerships look like and who they benefit?
So we've partnered both at IU with our IT colleagues. We call that unit UITS, University of Technology Information Services. And we have been partners of theirs back since the late 90s. They have had a presence in our building, but we have partnered with them on a couple of significant projects. The most significant one you may have read about, which is, we call it MDPI, Media Digitization and Preservation Initiative. And it is a presidential, so President McRobbie initiated this, and it's a $27 million project to digitize audio, video materials, and film. So we're just about finished with digitizing 325,000 AV materials, and we have made progress and digitized about 10,000 reels of film. So our IT colleagues and the library have partnered IT with the technology, and then the library, obviously, with the content. But we've also worked through grants to develop an access system that we call Media Collections Online, which is our instance of Avalon, which is the broader product that we've developed in partnership with a couple of other institutions. And also, so what that does then is allow us to make this digitized content accessible. Now, that's within the boundaries of copyright. And so we have materials that are accessible to researchers. And we also have materials that are accessible if you were a citizen of Indiana or not affiliated with the university, could walk into the library and access that as well. So that's a big project that we've taken on at IU in partnership with other academic libraries, and specifically the Big Ten. We have partnered with HathiTrust Digital Library, and that is a catalog of Google digitized content. And that is freely available for others to search, and to search the full text of the content of these books. So those are two big projects, I think, that we've been significantly involved in and had leadership roles in.
We're talking about the changing state of libraries, and we're joined by Ruth Lilly, Dean of University Libraries at Indiana University, Carolyn Walters, and we've been talking about the modern libraries and digitization. And on the flip side, while technology has become such a force in academic libraries, we also see a resurgence in the interest in primary sources. Can you first explain what we mean when we talk about these primitive things, I guess, if you will?
So primary sources to us are those things that are the original documents. So they could be a first edition of a book. It could be a manuscript from the 15th century. It could be modern political papers and the papers of a congressman from Indiana. It can be those kinds of materials that are the original source documents. We have a wonderful collection at the Lilly called the Krauss Newspaper Collections, and these are original early United States newspapers where founding fathers published articles in these newspapers to make those accessible to citizens in the United States. So we have these kinds of resources that we're working on engaging faculty and students to use. And we have found some wonderful reactions of students in the use of these original primary sources. So, for example, we have a student who participated in a class, visited the Lilly Library, and as part of her environmental literature class, studied the first edition of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And next to that first edition of his work was her mass paperback copy of it. And she was struck by the differences, as well as we had some papers that were his that talked about Leaves of Grass. And she was able to incorporate all of that and think about how he actually wrote on these papers. And they were his to begin with. So it's really quite an experience for students. And she then, in turn, wrote an article about this experience in the Indiana Daily Student, talking about the value of these resources and the value for somebody who's a biology and an English major to see humanities resources used in this way.
And do you have any other examples of interesting artifacts and primary sources that we might find at the Lilly Library there?
So Orson Welles. For example, we have Orson Welles' original recordings on lacquer disc of his Mercury Theater radio broadcasts, including War of the Worlds. So we have digitized that. Almost all of these things are out of copyright. So you could come to the Orson Welles site, the Lilly Library website, and listen to these recordings. But War of the Worlds is not yet out of copyright. So we have purchased access to that so that we can make it freely available for users to listen to. So those kinds of things, I think, are really quite exciting for people. And these are freely available for anyone to use. At the time these were made available, there's an Orson Welles group who were ecstatic about the quality of these recordings compared to open reel tape recordings that they had, and those had been digitized or they had to listen to them, that these are the highest quality recordings they've yet to hear of these radio broadcasts.
You have officially piqued my radio nerd interest. That sounds very intriguing.
Oh my gosh, these are really exciting. We have the actual discs still, which we keep in our offsite facility.
And one of the interesting items that IU Libraries houses is a lock of Sylvia Plath's hair. That's pretty cool, but how is it that a lock of her hair found its way to IU Libraries? How do those decisions get made?
Well, so that was part of a collection that Sylvia Plath's mother had that the Lilly Library acquired. So it came with papers. There was just something in the news not that long ago about a short story that was discovered in this group of papers, which we knew was there, but others weren't aware of it. So, and it had been on our website, but a researcher came to look at it along with the lock of the hair. But so this is part of a much larger collection, but it's just an interesting artifact that we happen to have.
And we've heard that collections themselves, when people hear about them, attract other collections. What do we mean by that?
That's exactly right. So literature. So we have a strong collection in 20th century literature. So Sylvia Plath's collection would be part of that. And that in turn attracts you said other collections. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the collection and the Lily is a lot of this is opportunistic. Things come up, things are made available, and we have an opportunity then to add to our collections.
And this kind of preservation is tied to the idea of cultural heritage as well. Can you explain what the idea behind cultural heritage is and the role that libraries play there?
Yes. So these things, what we were talking about with Orson Welles' recordings and Sylvia Plath's material, all reflect our culture at specific times. The writing, the poetry of a young woman, Orson Welles' recordings and the impact that radio broadcast had, especially War of the Worlds, those kinds of things, academic libraries make great effort to preserve for future generations. We've been doing that for years with print collections. So we buy what people need now, but we also buy with an idea towards the future as to what might be needed later. And then also, we have an extensive preservation lab here, and our media digitization preservation project is preserving these recordings. Some of the most exciting things that we're recording in the media, or in the MDPI project, are field recordings that ethnomusicologists have done. And we have what we believe is the first documented recording in China of an opera. And that we have digitized. We are working with the Tang Foundation in China to create a website to make these things accessible. We have some recordings from the African villages in Brazil that date to the 1940s. And we have worked with a researcher who's done a documentary on this topic, and he is returning digitized copies of these recordings to actual descendants of the people that were on the original recordings. So this kind of cultural heritage is, I think, these kinds of examples are prime examples of what we do and the importance of the work that we do in preservation.
Wow. Now, but I would imagine that these collections aren't necessarily cheap to fund. What makes it possible to finance collections or even some of these huge digitization projects?
Well, so we have President McRobbie very interested in collections and saw the value of these collections. And one of the principal, or one of the impetus behind this too, is that these formats are becoming obsolete and in some cases are disintegrating. And so it was timely that we embark on this digitization program so that we can preserve these in addition to the equipment is no longer available in some cases to play these recordings. So that that pushed, I think, us to move forward with this project after several studies that were done on this and showing that these collections were deteriorating.
Now, we know that there have been shifts in the way that we access and interact with material at libraries, but what about the physical space available at libraries themselves? I think many of us think of academic libraries as quiet study spaces. Does that remain the same?
No. And we have food, too.
Okay, great.
No, as a matter of fact, as teaching has changed, our space has changed as well. So we have collaborative spaces, group spaces. We still have quiet study spaces. We have different types of equipment for students to use. So we have partners in the building, which when I started here 32 years ago, we did not have. So writing tutorial services provide services to students. Our computing colleagues are in the building providing support for different types of computing applications as well as equipment. But as far as space goes, one of the things I did want to mention is that we talked earlier about primary sources and the increased use in those, and that has led to a huge increase in the use of the Lilly Library in terms of instruction. We've had a 350% increase since 1992 in the number of students that are coming to the Lilly Library in classes to use the resources, which then we worked with President McRobbie, and he approached the Lilly Endowment, and we have received a $10.9 million grant to renovate the Lilly Library, which will create some much-needed classroom space to be able to use these collections more broadly with more students.
In the last minute that we have, we've talked a lot about the changes within these academic libraries today, and I think it's fair to say that in a relatively short period of time, a lot has shifted. What do you think the future of academic libraries looks like?
More change.
In short.
In short, yeah, if you want a short answer. But yes, I mean, I think that the more we digitize and the more that students take advantage of that in terms of research, I think we're going to see increased use in libraries.
She's the Ruth Lilly Dean of University Libraries at Indiana University, Carolyn Walters. Dean Walters, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Subscribe to our podcast so you always know what we're talking about. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk about the death penalty. Indiana recently marked 10 years since our last execution, and we look forward to your input on tomorrow's show. Tweet us at All In Indiana or find us on Facebook. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.